Welcome to IGB Podcast, iGaming Checkup with Dr. Eyal, brought to you by IGB in partnership with Replay. I'm Dr. Eyal. I've been passionate about games and the people that makes them for many years. Humans have been playing games of chance even before we could write. So what is going on here? Why gambling games are so central to our experience as a species? And why something as simple as a slot machine is also the hardest game to make? Sure. There are plenty of iGaming podcasts out there covering industry trends and headlines. But this isn't just more of the same. We are here to challenge assumptions, invite sideways thinkers and industry outsiders, and explore the complexity of an ever-evolving, fascinating, and innovative space. If you are ready to think differently about iGaming, you are in the right place. Let's go. Okay, so this is IGB Podcast, iGaming Checkup with Dr. Eyal. I'm here with Dr. Kasra Gaharian. Nice to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's nice to meet you.
Yeah, so what we'll be discussing in this episode, I really want to do this. Like, I give you an offer, you cannot refuse. Yeah, so the thing is, from The Godfather. But really, like, when we're looking at players, and seriously now, right? Like, what motivate players, and what the role that we play as game designers or producers or really as an industry. So when we look at the reasons that players play, like players play to play, do they play to win? What is it unique to iGaming? Those motivations. Is there any ethical or moral considerations that we need to take? And for me, I'd like to start like looking at the work that you've been doing. Many panels, when I come and I say, players play to play, not to win. Actually, they play to play, not to win. Everyone looks really, really surprised. So I thought from a data perspective, you know, like if you look at players' behavior from where your perch. When you look at the data, for example, do you see, players that tend to say churn or change their behavior after they have a really large win? Or do you see that, players that like they say even that the level of a session or the level of a complete behavior? Like, would you see a player completely disappear when they win? Or what do you see in general with players over their lifetime?
Yeah, I think, there's a couple of, nuggets of information that at least I've gleaned from some of the work we've done. Typically there are the players that gamble a lot. They play a lot. They usually account for a smaller percentage of the player base. We've looked at bank data, as I said, so they make up a smaller proportion of that population as well. And, it's typically about 5%, maybe 10% of a population is really highly engaged. Like, these people gamble maybe daily or weekly, and they're doing so for long periods of time. They're gambling all year. Whereas, the rest of the population, they seem to maybe are more casual, if you want to describe them that way. They're betting less frequently, lower volumes and that kind of thing. So I guess you can tell maybe motivations are different between just those kind of variables. More recently, we've done some work with it might not be so interesting to this podcast audience, but we've done some work with land-based slot machine data, where we've been looking at what is the determining factors that make people stay in a casino or on a machine. And it's quite interesting that, we have, I think, win-loss in there, like the position of a player, how much they've won or how much they've lost a prior session or during a session. And it doesn't seem to explain that much why someone would leave a casino or stay at the casino. So to your point, if we look at that, maybe it isn't about winning and losing. Maybe it is just about playing, because if it is about winning and losing, then you would expect that variable to have a large explanatory power, and we're potentially not seeing that massive explanatory power from that variable.
So yeah, what I would expect from a game design perspective is really that, like, the win event itself, it's it's a part of the whole orchestra of experience rather than just the win event. And I find it surprising that people find this surprising. I thought, why are the players are there in the first place? They are there for an experience rather than, you know, like a financial outcome. Like, you know, you in your past, you were playing poker, right? So when you are a good poker player, then you are there for a financial outcome. But 90% of players are not good poker players. They are there for an experience. And they are there chasing a certain, you know, like even a meaningful experience. And in a way, you are the better poker player, the slot machine for those players who are chasing, you know, chasing those rare events, those runners that will give them that real meaningful moment where, yeah, like when at the end of the day, they are not really there to win money at the end. And probably if you look at their bankroll over time, you'll see that it's actually slowly decreasing, just like a slot player. So I find that very non-surprising. But there's a guy named John Hobson. He wrote a post in a journal called Gamma Sutra about 24 years ago. He talked about the, you know, the behavioral game design, like the random reward schedules, and he talked about the work of B.F. Skinner, right? And I remember, like, at the time when it came out, it just blew up. Like, the games up to that point were not the same as the games from that article henceforth. And now when I look on games, a successful game, casual games, I would say that show me a good game, I will show you the slot machine inside it. It might not be a slot machine, just like I said earlier, like as a poker player, a good poker player at the table, you are the slot machine for the players around you. Every good game that creates that experience, the players, they play to play, not to win. And the win event doesn't actually change their behavior. And I was kind of wondering, like, have you ever looked, when you look at iGaming data, have you ever looked at data from other industries, like for casual players, for social players, in other gaming? And do you see any similarities in the data and players' behavior?
Yeah, we've looked at like payments data before. And, you know, from that, you don't see any gaming behavior or playing behavior from that. You're just seeing deposits and withdrawals. But even from that, you can kind of glean in some insights, right? You can see how frequently they're depositing. Did they cancel a withdrawal? You know, that's a weird one. You know, they've asked for the money, but they're like, oh no, wait a second, I actually want to keep that money on the system. So that's all weird ones. I think, like, I don't know, going back to your point about poker and, you know, why people play, I guess this isn't really grounded in any kind of academic research I've done, but yeah, I guess like there is that motivation to just experience something. And I think, you know, when I play poker, yeah, some of the time it wasn't about the money. I used to love multi-table tournaments, and that is more about, it's like playing a sport, you know, it was like more competitive. So that was about more of the experience. I also think like, risk-taking is something that's interesting. Not risk-taking in terms of like gambling and money, but just risk-taking in general. I think that's maybe something that humans, it just feeds into some human psyche, right? That we want to take risk. We kind of enjoy it a little bit. So any game that kind of feeds on that kind of risk-taking component is probably going to be engaging as well, right?
No, I absolutely agree. But at the core of it, the risk-taking has to align with a random reward schedule, with the fact that when you actually do an action, you don't know what you're getting back. And again, when you look at B.F. Skinner and that article, the behavioral game design, and the design of pretty much all modern games nowadays, all the successful one at least, you know, there's probably plenty that are less successful. Now, when your kids are playing Roblox or something, that's what they're experiencing. You know, they're experiencing that random reward schedule when they do actions and they don't quite know what they're going to get in return. And that risk taking is what keeps you going. But you see, like, for me, like, one look at my career as a product person, as a game designer, a real point was reading the work of Natasha Scholl, the book called Addiction by Design. And one thing that really dawned on me reading some of the research there is that really players do connect with this experience in a way that really means something to them. Like it's they get into this zone of play that really puts them away from distractions, from maybe problems that they have. They really are in this zone, and for that to happen, you really need that. You really need that, like, random remote scratch, that randomness happening. And I find that, like, you know, this is something that is quite meaningful, and it's quite funny. Like our technician James, earlier when we talked, he told me, you know, I had a recording earlier today, and everything went wrong. Everything went wrong, and therefore this recording has to work out quite well. And I was thinking, this is really interesting, because this is exactly at the core of our experience. I call it the transitivity of lack. Or we experience lack as something that we possess. And as we possess lack, engaging with games of chance, gambling games and games in general, but games that measure a level of lack, becomes quite meaningful.
Okay, I guess like randomness as well is just probably interesting to us. Because we, you know, you have your routine or your daily routine. You wouldn't want a game that's the same every time, I guess. So, like, the randomness probably is intriguing in that aspect as well. I don't know. There's probably something to the randomness, right?
I think that, yeah, like we try to find patterns in everything, right? Like, I mean, when you look at data, you try to find patterns, right? Now, if you look at any kind of input, you'll try to find patterns. That's just what we do. That's what our brain does without thinking. And then randomness keeps you going indefinitely. There's always going to be a reason to find a pattern, and you're always going to get very close to the feeling of seeing a pattern, but there's never going to be a pattern quite there.
So as a designer... So I'm going to ask you a question. Yeah.
Yes.
So as a designer, so like, what if you're looking at, is there like data-driven design? So what kind of like outcomes are you looking at in the data to inform design?
So we really look at things like retention and the number of the size of the sessions and how frequently players come back to play a game. And the thing is that you really try to get to this abstraction of what indicators it tells you that this is a good game, and then try to understand what it is in that flow of the game that made it so, and then try to, you know, create variants on that. But there is a lot of data driving those decisions, but at the same time there's a strong element of art. Like you don't quite know how to explain things. You've got the data, you've got the mathematics that drives the combinatorics element of any, you know, of any game.
I guess to my point earlier, it's like, yeah, you have these objective measures, right? But you've got nothing telling you like enjoyment or anything like that. That's why I wonder like you know when I watch a Netflix movie, right, I can give it a thumbs up, thumbs down. I like it. Are you seeing the same stuff in iGaming?
Absolutely. Like you see that, first of all, you see that good games are sticky. Like they tend to resonate with many, many players. There's something about them resonate with many players, and they transcend different regions, and they transcend the sometimes even demographics, right? And bad games usually they sink quite fast. But, and that's the big but, like you can have a bad game with a change of art that becomes a good game, and a good game with a change of art that becomes a bad game. And then you're saying, okay, so there's the science that guides you, and then there's also the arts and the intuition. But I was kind of wondering, like saying that, how do you find the data with players' behavior in terms of their deposits and engagement. How do you find the changing between different regions? Is this something that you see any kind of difference, or do you see is this something universal?
I mean, I've done analyses on like a US data set, a UK data set. I think we've done a recent one on a Polish data set. So we've done like similar analyses there, and you do see the similar things. Like I was saying, you see like highly engaged players, like high rollers, maybe people who are at a certain risk of harm. Then you have the more casual bettors as well. And you kind of see those same patterns across the board, I think. And, you know, even other studies outside of our lab, like that have done similar analyses, you always kind of see this same structure along the population. So, yeah, I think there are similarities in terms of engagement, but at a granular level, I can't really speak to that.
And do you think that, like, when you look at the data sets, right? Like, are you able to take into account things like the normal wealth distribution? Because you can say, well, this player is super engaged. You know, he might at risk of harm, but actually, this player is a multimillionaire, and for them to get that kind of meaningful excitement for their experience, they really need to engage. Like, and then you end up having a high roller, whereas it might be that in terms of you know, like a utility or net worth, there might be another player playing 1/1000th of that, and they're actually the players at harm, and they are the players that actually are, you know. So have you ever considered that? Yeah, that vertical?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, that's been, you know, I think a long time criticism, a limitation of the data that was being analyzed from the different operators. There was no kind of view into the individual's financial situation, which is a big limiting factor. Like you said, you know, $100 bet to one person could be completely different from $100 bet to another person. So yeah, we've had the benefit to work with some really interesting open banking data sets, specifically from the United Kingdom. We formed a relationship with a Department of Trust, Charles Curran. I don't know if you or your listeners are familiar with him, but he we worked with him on some data analysis on open banking data in the UK. More recently, we did an analysis of 1 million customers who have shared this bank data. And with that bank data, you can obviously see income. You can see if they're paying a mortgage. You can see if they're using buy now, pay later products or payday loans. So you get a much more individual financial view of a customer, and you see their gambling activity. You don't see what games they're playing, you know, or if they're playing a slot machine for so long or how much each bet is, but you do see deposits to different gambling merchants. So, I mean, to summarize some of the findings we found with that, you know, generally speaking, again, you get these really highly engaged gamblers, and typically they skew younger, maybe more male. Income isn't really, it seems to be a bit more scattered amongst the highly engaged group. One thing we have looked at is the new £150 threshold in the UK for soft financial checks. We were interested in exploring that because, you know, the motivation behind that risk check is to, you know, prevent financial harms amongst gamblers. So we were interested in terms of, okay, what kind of people are hitting these £150 thresholds? Do they all look the same? Are their engagement level the same? Is the income distribution consistent between those people? And it was quite interesting. I think we found basically that of the people who hit these £150 thresholds, you kind of see two groups of people. So one, yeah, maybe they're warranting a check because we looked at their leisure spending. You know, so not just their gambling spending, their dining, their going to movies, purchasing sporting events, or all of those things. So for one group who hit these £150 thresholds, almost, I think, greater than 90% of their leisure spend was on gambling. But then there was another group where gambling only accounted for maybe 20-30% of their leisure spend. So it seemed as though gambling was more part of a, you know, just holistic leisure spend. These people like to spend money on lots of different things as well as gambling. So that was interesting. And that's the power of open banking data and financial transaction data, is that you can start to add objective context to what these gamblers are doing. So I think it's really powerful. And I'm looking forward to see how it advances, harm prevention in the space.
And do you think, like, for you, from talking with operators, do you think that the incentives are set up correctly for, speaking from a supplier point of view, like for us at RubyPlay, we do believe that we don't want to see players come to harm. Like, we think it's actually a bad idea. We want what we want is players really having a meaningful experience at the budget that they can afford over long periods of time. It's better for them to have a habit that will still see them enjoying this in 10 years' time, 15 years' time, than to just like blow up a budget, might even be not a very large budget, but more than they can afford, and then churn. So I think that in many ways, the incentives are aligned such that for us as an industry, we do want to protect players, even though it seems counterintuitive because, or at least that's the outside view of the industry, is that we just want to get as much money as we can, as quickly as we can, and to bring players to extinction as quickly as we can, or the player's wallet to extinction. So, I mean, what do you think about the incentives in your experience and we're talking with different people in the industry?
I think the industry does have a challenge in terms of that narrative. I've heard it thrown around a lot. And I'm going to be quite candid here that, we want a responsible gambler. We want a customer to be with us for a long time. I don't know if I've seen like kind of hard data on whether that's like a solid business strategy. Because at least from what I've seen, the gambling industry seems highly reliant on a small proportion of customers. Maybe 10% of customers contribute to the large majority of gambling revenues. And how sustainable those customers, I don't know. I haven't done any longitudinal analysis. But I think that it makes sense though. What you're saying, yeah, without a doubt, kind of makes sense. I guess I'm just saying I haven't seen kind of any hard evidence as to whether that's gonna be a sustainable business model.
See, but coming from myself, designing casual games, designing social games, designing all kinds of games over my career, it seems to always be the case. Like, you always have about 10% of players driving 80% of the revenue. You have like the VIPs, and to me it feels like we have those systems, those machines, little machines, entertainment machines that give people certain experiences. And when you talk about iGaming, I even heard in some of your interviews, there's this element of controversy, when it's like nobody seems to be very concerned about, say, like a match three game done by King, but they would be concerned about a slot machine, running in a regulated environment. Where at the end of the day, you would see very similar behaviors, very similar drivers of the revenues, very similar players group behaving in similar ways. And I would argue even the players experiencing similar experiences. What's your experience in general when that controversy element of iGaming as an academic?
In terms of so we call it the Pareto rule, right? Where there's 20% of something contributes to 80% of the revenue. Like, I think that kind of rule surfaces across various facets of life. I guess to my point earlier, I think it's a challenge that the gambling industry might need to solve, because they're getting squeezed by regulators in certain jurisdictions. So I'm just wondering, at what point is that squeeze going to be too hard to maintain that small fraction of customers? Because if there's continued regulatory pressure, that's going to cut into the margins and so forth. So I don't know. It's interesting.
But the thing is, like, how much of it comes from, again, for what I'm saying, like the idea that there's something in iGaming that gets this kind of a bad
threat.
Yeah. Like in an interview, I heard you saying that you went to visit a different state, and you talk with some friends where there is no iGaming industry there. And then when you were saying that you work within the iGaming, that they looked at you a little bit funny, you know. So I mean, how much of it you feel is you know, like, is it actually a limiting factor for you as an academic trying to do this kind of research when you try to create those connections and work with large institutions?
I don't think it's been a limiting factor for us. You know, at the Institute here, International Gaming Institute, we have it's been around a lot longer than I've been here. I think I've been here, like, you know, 5 years. I've been director of research now for 1 year. But the Institute's been here for like 30, 35 years, really at the forefront in terms of providing thought leadership on all aspects of the global gambling sector. So I benefit from the Institute's reputation in that respect.
That's branding.
A lot of people know about UNLV, so that's always a nice thing to open with. But, you know, I think, you know, more recently with the work we're doing around AI, that's been really positively received, I think. You know, yeah, safer gambling, responsible gambling is part of that initiative, but it's more about balancing AI innovation opportunities with what the challenges are, with what the risks are. We definitely see it as a more comprehensive approach to solving these problems. So I think that's how we successfully frame a lot of our research projects is it's not like the AI research hub, right? It's not just about gambling harms. It's about how can we leverage this technology for all of the benefit that it's going to provide? Cause yeah, I'm a bit of an AI optimist. I think there's like massive benefits to have with that technology, but I also understand that there's concerns around, you know, algorithmic bias, workforce displacement, all of these things. And I think it's just important to study it holistically, not just have a bias towards one certain angle. So I say that's how we maybe approach things. And maybe that's how we get more positive reviews, if you will.
But, you know, like when we look at the industry and, you know, prevention of how much of it, you know, is about player education. Like I heard you speak about this in the past as well. And I find this quite interesting, like from the player perspective themselves, like, you know, how do we get players to engage with gambling games in a way that is healthier, in a way that is more sustainable?
Yeah, you know, I think it's been a bit of a long commentary now on like RG tool use, how there's not like great adoption of these tools. I think there's some interesting things going on in the States with how, you know, the sports book are starting to pitch these tools. There's some really cool like advertisements. I think, I can't remember which one it is, so I'm not going to name the names, but they're doing some really cool like RG tool use adverts where they're kind of putting a comedic spin on it, making it a bit more accessible. But I think, like, to me, a real challenge with RG tools in general is that they're like siloed to like a single operator, right? So, okay, I can set a deposit limit on this one sports book. It doesn't kind of feed into this kind of mental accounting I need of all of my spending activities that I do on a daily basis. And this is going to go back to banking and why I think it's important there. But I think we need more kind of like financial literacy. I think that's going to be a really important aspect of all of this. Is what does gambling look like in terms of all of my other financial obligations and all of my other financial spending? I think that's going to be a lot more powerful. And I know Kindbridge are really trying to lead this initiative where they're trying to, like, you know, really focus on financial literacy, financial health as a way to kind of have this real, like, you know, preventative measure that comes right before any gambling harms take place later down the line. So I think education around those things early on is really important. Because, yeah, I don't know, these RG tools on websites and things, they just seem to be challenging in terms of getting user adoption.
But the thing is, you know, like, let me be controversial, right? Like, you know, Warren Buffett famously installed a slot machine in his house for, you know, and he used to give his kids the allowance, and then they went and played the slot machine. Initially, they played it quite enthusiastically, and at some point, they realized, wait a minute, maybe this is not a very good idea. And it's like how he exposed his kids to the idea of, you know, engaging with some with the gambling experience in a soft way. And I'm thinking, you know, like, maybe by the point that you actually try to create this literacy about financial management, about gambling and all that, habits have been created in a way that is very, very hard to change. You know, it's like you've got like the, I once heard you say, like, comparing alcohol consumption and gaming. And I think that if you look at the American approach, you will wait till you're 21, you will not touch alcohol, and then people completely lose it. Actually, it's the same, very similar in Australia, but it's just the age of 18. I once been to somebody's 18th party, and it was like a complete disaster. Where in Europe, where I live now, it's more common to, even for 12-year-olds, for young kids to taste a little bit of red wine with dinner here and then. And all of a sudden, when they get to an age where they do it on their own, it's not a big deal. You know, they don't go out and completely, you know, lose. So I'm wondering, like, how do you get
my colleague Alan Feldman? He's often spoke, I think for the past year or two at least, he's often spoke about the role of parents in terms of, you know, harm prevention, gambling risk, educating their children about gambling from an early age. Because to your point about alcohol, right, we have conversations with our kids about alcohol, maybe introduce them, you know, have a sip or whatever. But I don't know if a lot of parents do the same things with gambling. I think I remember, you know, placing a bet on the Grand National, you know, or, you know, my mom helped me place a bet on the Grand National, but there wasn't a deep conversation in terms of, you know, what the risk might be or whatever. It was just
playing poker with the kids.
You know, this is a fine thing to do. You can just, you know, do it. Like, so yeah, maybe that does need to be a bit more, but you know, when it was drink, it was like, oh, don't drink too much. Like, you know,
don't go all in, not now.
Yeah. But you know, I think to your point, I think that's important, like, because I think you know, if you look at people's who get into problems, they have like misconceptions about winning, they don't understand probability. So, you know, maybe if they did have that understanding going into the activity, they'd be able to like regulate their spending or whatever a bit better, because they'd actually understand the mechanics and the probability, how winning works and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that looking at data is super important, giving us more of an insight. I think it's really interesting when you say, like, I look at the data, but I don't really see motivation. But I also think that, you know, sometimes for me as a game designer, I look at the data and all I try to do is to create the, you know, a mental intuition on around motivation. So it's quite interesting there. And yes, thanks for taking your time and discussing those topics with me.
Well, yeah, no, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on. Look forward to speaking with you again soon.
Thanks, Kasper. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of IGB Podcast, iGaming Checkup with Dr. Eyal. There's plenty more to come, so stay with us for more eye-opening, thought-provoking, and stigma-challenging conversations that dig deeper into the world of iGaming.